Welcome. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. Yep, we have another great show tonight dealing with metaphysics and spirituality and very interesting things about the creation and development of knowledge. You've heard me talk about knowledge before. Tonight I'm going to explain it in a way that you probably haven't heard of unless you've studied some of the material I've written in great detail. It's going to be new. And it may be a little bit complicated, although I'm going to give some, I think, to be interesting examples that will help all of you to understand some very, we'll say, esoteric and, well, conceptually difficult concepts. You know, the things that most people would say, wow, that's way out there, you know. But this is going to really explain what knowledge is, because most people don't know. And it's going to explain how it works. And the most important thing, I guess, is where it even comes from, because as you might know, there's only three parts to God's mind, and none of those are really knowledge. Knowledge is a byproduct. It's like a leftover part. And I'll explain all that as we get going tonight. And there's going to be some science involved in this, too, because we're going to be talking about fields and how a field of thought and a field of this and a potential that. And there'll be some interesting elements of all of that, too. So hopefully you'll find it to be as interesting as I do, because this is really neat stuff. And also it's unavailable to my understanding anyplace else you might look. So what do I mean when I'm talking about knowledge? Knowledge has to do with the creation of and the way creation of thought is done. So thought is its own thing. For those of you who aren't familiar with prior shows, thought is the following. Thought is two or more choices in a specific or similar direction. Okay, the choices are moving in a direction means that they have some commonality to them. And they have an effect on the field that they exist in. Now, a field is like an area of thought that is self-contained. And within that field, the thought tends to, we'll say, make the field change by creating a direction to some of the thoughts in the field. And therefore, the choices in the thought, we can sometimes refer to that if they're consistent, like will or purpose, those choices are dynamic. They affect the field as they move in a common direction. And as long as they affect the field that they're in, then you have the complete definition of thought. If you have a bunch of choices that even have direction, but they have no effect on the field that they are contained within, there's no thought that's taken place. Okay. But that's what I mean by thought. And that is such a big subject. I'm only going to give you a definition of that. That if you haven't read or thought about that in the past, well, that's just something to think about in the future. But for right now, we're not going to go any deeper into that very, very deep subject. All right. So I'm going to start today talking about the bigger parts of our universe, the things that most people don't understand or think about, but are really the foundations of what makes our universe a universe. And to begin with, there's God. God has three parts to its existence or mind. The first part of its mind is those choices we talked about. And the choices that God has are all the choices in its mind that can be, that ever will be, within our universe. So all the choices that have ever been are actually part of God's mind within our universe. However, God does not necessarily bring those into full consciousness. So God doesn't take every choice and make it into a specific direction. And for sure, many of the choices, even that are directed by God, do not alter or have an effect on the universe itself. And you're going to say, well, why is that? Because the third part of God's mind, which is called intelligent activity, some people call it perfection in intelligent activity. It doesn't matter which way you refer to it. Perfection, to me, is a little redundant, but it can be said that way. God chooses not to do anything with the thoughts and direction to its thoughts that it has. It says, you know, all the activity I'm going to give in a unified and completely evenly spread out amount to all of the quote-unquote dimensionality, all of the fields, all of the potential fields that I'm going to make. This is what God says. And I'm going to give this whole system of fields of potential intelligent activity to a new thing, which is life. So life is going to activate the field of potential so that instead of God doing it, which would be kind of interesting, but not to God, we do it, and all kinds of other life do it. And this gives the potential and the actual growth of the universe, the growth of these fields, the interaction of the fields together and within themselves as well, gives it to this thing called life instead of under the supervision, so to speak, or control of God. And you can say, well, why would God do that? I mean, what's the big deal? Well, the big deal is that part of the system, when you have choices with direction that affect a field, which is called independent thought, it produces freedom. And that's also part of the first part of God's mind. And the first thought that God probably has is that there needs to be freedom. Freedom allows the room for there to be life, you see. And it allows for God to grow without it being a puppet show of sorts, where everything is just some pre-planned, predestined activity. And that wouldn't be any fun for anybody. It would be extremely boring and of no significant value. God determined that the real value is in helping new things that it helps to create, that themselves are co-creators in, become potentially new gods at some point in the vast future, but nonetheless develop themselves into life, which takes on the role of doing all the activity. Hopefully you're following this. This is really deep. This explanation of the beginning of our universe, the creator itself of God, is one that just brings a smile to my face. It allows me to sleep at night and to enjoy the days as well, because it tells me that the God of our universe is incredibly loving, because it gives us this, it's like a huge gift. And it is incredibly wise, because it realizes that without it removing a major part of its role, which is all activity, and even its thought is only there when something else is taking intelligent actions. That's the only time God's thought is there. It's when the activity is perfectly intelligent. I'm going to explain perfectly intelligent in a minute. But still, this means that God is limited by itself. It chooses to limit itself so that we and all other kinds of life can exist as we do, as free agents with free will and the ability to co-create with our Creator, rather than be servants to or independent of our Creator. Although part of life, if it so choose, could be independent from God, at least up to a certain point, but we call that part evil. Nonetheless, it still has that option. All right, so what then do I mean by intelligent activity? Because there's a activity, most people have some idea what that means, although I'll define it much better. But intelligent activity is the following. It's any time one blank, and you can call it a thing if you want, perfectly communicates its intention, its purpose, its direction, everything about itself to some other thing. That's intelligent activity. When there's perfect communication between two, we'll call it forms, that are informed by spirit, we'll get to that part. Those things, right now we call them things, are intelligently active, or perfectly intelligently active. But the word intelligent activity replaces perfectly intelligent activity, because there is no other intelligent activity other than perfect intelligent activity. But if you prefer that, you can have the word perfect before it, if you think that further defines it for your understanding. That's okay. All right. Something that doesn't have intelligent activity has a whole array of changes. When something is intelligent in activity, it is within the field of God's own thought. It's in God's field, God's dimension. Now, where is God's dimension? It's sometimes referred to as the ultimate plane, the highest plane of our universe, the plane of Adi, of all. Yeah, some people refer to it that way. And, there's a whole bunch of other names for it. But this first dimension, this biggest dimension, is the biggest field in our universe. And it's from that field that the thought of God is actually contained. And there's seven subtypes of God's thought that are potential in activity. But they don't have any activity because God chooses to take no activity. So if we were to visit God's activity, we could only be observers within it. We could not take any activity ourselves because God chooses not to. But we would experience God as God is. Wow. We would directly experience our own creator. It's like meeting it in total, in this other grand field of Adi. Amazing. Yeah. Okay, so that's the plane of all, the plane of oneness. Well, it's not oneness. That's another plane. The plane of all, the field of all, is where God is at. In this field, no activity takes place. It is the ultimate potential of activity, intelligent activity, to exist there. But it doesn't actually actualize itself. You can see why, because God chose it to be that way. Now, that's pretty cool if you think about it, because that means if we could get there, we would experience being God, and we, all of us, are destined at some point, it could be a long ways, in what we call our future. It isn't our personal future, because it's long, long after we, as personal beings, will exist. But as our eventual larger being that we're going to re-establish ourselves with, called the monad, we eventually will enter that field of God's monad. And we'll, as a thing called a silent watcher, because we can't do anything other than that, we'll become part of God. For a while. Not forever. And some people would say it's a timeless state, so it's hard to even talk about it in that respect. All right. So God exists in this kind of timeless state. And why is it timeless? Well, because in order for there to be time, there must be less than perfectly intelligent activity. However, God exists in which case the activity is perfect, but it's also kept separate. So time exists, but it also doesn't exist. God is aware of all time in all dimensions below its own, but also lives in a timeless existence as well. Hard for us to understand that, I know. best way to think of it is this. Think of your whole life up to this point. And imagine, if you can, that you were born with an understanding of your entire life up to this point. You knew everything that was going to happen to some extent. Now, the extent is that you didn't know all the activities that were going to happen, but you knew all the thoughts that you might have. Okay. But you didn't know all the activities. And you could, at any particular time, kind of statistically figure out what the likelihood or unlikelihood is of something happening, but that would be the best you could do. Well, in a way, that's where God's at. And then, in addition to that, you already are at the end of your life, and the beginning, and the middle. You're at all the points in your life, as far as your thinking is concerned. Because you have, and you can live through all the possible ways that you might have some thoughts or think in a certain way. It's an amazing kind of existence, but you're not able to be in experience of all the interactions that are going to take place outside of your dimension, because that you're giving to life. So that's kind of what God is experiencing. I know that sounds a little bit tricky to understand. I got it. But it's too big for us to really fathom. And it just gives us something to realize. And it isn't just God that experiences that. It's any of these, they're called ascended monads, that actually enters into this field of God's mind. Wow. And that's us someday. Someday we'll be there. So don't think we're not going to get there. We will. But for right now, we'll just be where we are. Okay. All right. So we got that dimension. Now, God also wants to have a part, a co-sponsoring part of existence. And this has to do with other gods and other dimensions, too. But we won't get into too much of that. It's very complicated. But the God of our universe, which we call God, seeks to be open to connections with other universes and with beings that have exceeded even its godliness. And there actually are many that have done it, or at least some. And it allows this to take place by there being a second field that it produces. And that second field has a being that's the lord of that field. And that's a being that exists in and out of our universe. And besides that, there are sub-beings called monads. Now, these are descended monads, not ascended monads. What's a descended monad? A descended monad is a monad that exists on the plane of one, or sometimes referred to as the monadic plane. And in that realm, again, the monads are just like God. They decide, hey, you know what? We got all this potential intelligent activity. We'll do the same thing God does. We'll keep it separate. We will think as one together, because where there's zillions of monads, we'll think of one as one together. But we will take no action ourselves. Instead, we will create life in dimensions below our own that will have form, will have our thought in part, which we call spirit. Spirit is like God's thought, several degrees lower. It's really the monad's thought, but a lot of times it's just referred to as God's thought. And will help life to grow through a process called the development of kingdoms. Kingdoms protects life from other life and allows it to grow in ways in which it is somewhat isolated for a while from other life. It's pretty interesting way of growing. All right, so these monads on the monadic plane are participating in the creation of life because they have perfect intelligent activity, just like God, but they keep it separate from themselves. And then it's in their dimension, but it's kept totally separate. So none of they deliberately through their will prevent any of their thought from having effect on it. God does the same thing. And so they're replicating their own creator. Pretty cool. And they also are giving their own thought to a large extent to the life that is created in fields of spirit and what we call energy below their dimension in a smaller field from where they are. Wow. It's pretty cool. Okay. If you're with me so far, this should be making still, hopefully, some sense. I'm trying to keep it as simple as I can. All right. So then what happens? Well, part of the monad's thought that's focused on a certain part or segment of life that exists in a kingdom that is in a part of time and space segregated from most other life, and some of that life is in the physical dimension where we are, sometimes referred to as the etheric physical or electromagnetic physical, and part of it, other monads focus on life in the astral. Other monads focus on life in the mental or maniacic dimension. Other monads focus on life in the intuitional dimension. And finally, some monads focus on life in the spiritual dimension. Wow. They all got their own little niches, you might say. The more advanced the monad, the more it can focus on life on a higher dimension of time and space. A higher dimension being the highest that it can reach is the spiritual. And the spiritual is where stars are created from. Wow. Pretty cool. Okay. So, monads are really involved intimately, we might say, with stars because that's a dimension right below theirs. And they are connected oftentimes to a very specific star and to the planets that star creates life on. So they're segregated not only by the, we'll call it, kingdom that they're focused on at a particular time in their development, but they're also collectively part of a specific star system and the planets that star develops. Very, very interesting stuff. All right. So all that making some sense at this point, I hope. Then you could say, well, okay, then where does all this lead us to? We've got this intelligent activity, et cetera. Well, part of the thought of monads, which is really thinking very much as a reflection of God's thought, becomes spirit on the next plane down, sometimes referred to as the plate of dimension of Atma or Atmic dimension, and it has to do with spirit. And that spirit is, and it's also referred to as a spiritual plane. That spirit is in big terms a thinking element that is going to try to now rejoin itself with what the monads didn't have in their dimension because they sacrificed it, which was the intelligent activity. But the intelligent activity, when it gets lower than the monadic dimension, is no longer perfectly intelligent. Now, that's a big deal. Now we're getting close to understanding where knowledge is going to come from. Since this intelligent activity that has been all this time being kept separate on God's dimension, on the monad's dimension, now the intelligent activity, boom, becomes manifested, and it develops itself into two specific kinds of, we'll say, things. The first thing it develops into, the intelligent part, when it's less than perfectly intelligent, becomes... Are you ready? becomes knowledge. Yeah. The intelligence becomes knowledge. Knowledge is not intelligence. What's the difference? Knowledge is not perfect. Not perfect. Knowledge is an imperfect part of intelligence. Pure or perfect intelligence is knowledge that has been brought to the point where it, in all terms, in all time, has is consistent in time and space and never fails to communicate perfectly from one part of energy to another. I mean, we're going to get to energy in a second. But that's what knowledge, when it's perfect, does, and then it becomes intelligence, perfect intelligence by some people's standards. But again, intelligence is, it's redundant, but we'll call it perfect intelligence. And when knowledge isn't, when intelligence doesn't exist, or it isn't perfect at least, then you get knowledge. And knowledge could be very imperfect. It could be so imperfect that it may be as wrong as you can imagine. It could be goofy. It can produce very bad communication, and when it doesn't communicate in a way from one form to another form, you end up with a thing called force. So knowledge, when it is imperfect, develops forces. Okay. And the forces are, there's four kinds of forces that have been identified for, by physics. One of these forces is gravity. But physics doesn't know what gravity is. Physics is the imperfect way that some types of energy responds. And that is when energy responds by saying, hey, I just want to be hang out with other energy. It's kind of like myself, and we can all get bigger and kind of turn into a sphere. When energy reacts that way, yeah, it develops a force, a field of force, and the field of force is called gravity. Now, physics today, modern physics, doesn't know that. If it did, I mean, if it was an accepted part of physics, everything in physics would change because all the problems of physics has today would go away. But they don't know. You could say, well, could they read that book you wrote, the textbook, The Life Should Meaning? Yeah, they could. If they would, and if they really followed everything I said, it would, it, even mathematically, it would work out, but they don't. So, we'll see. 25 years, maybe 50 years from now, maybe it will be understood that way. That's assuming I'm right, and ageless wisdom in general is right, because this isn't just me. Okay, so, pretty cool so far. We're kind of getting somewhere, right? Now, what about the activity part? Because I only talked about the intelligence part, but I've been using the word energy, so you kind of get to get the message here. The activity is no longer intelligent. And when it's no longer intelligent, the activity becomes two things. It becomes the potential, okay, to create forces and to create, then there's four kinds of identified forces in physics. There's actually more, but we'll just call them that for right now. And it has the potential to do things, and we'll call that power. Okay, so it develops tremendous power potentials. Power is the ability, at least the potential ability, to do work. Or where something is doing work, you can figure it out. At some way, there's some definitions, but that's a very limited definition. So it develops power. And at the very top of the spiritual plane, after the monadic, very beginning of the spiritual plane, where all this stuff is starting to happen, anything that exists there becomes all-powerful. Sounds pretty cool, but it's really not as developed as a monad. But it's still a lot of power. A lot of power exists there. That means the potential to change spirit and form together, producing, we'll say, either forces or the development of new life. One of the two is going to happen. Wow. So you get forces of developing new life out of this power, this tremendous power. The other thing that's developed, when the power becomes actualized, actualized means that it's no longer a potential to do something, it's actually doing it. It creates forms, which is composed of energy. So there's tons of energy. And then there's also the potential to have energy, which is still called power. Wow. And you have, from either one of those, you could have the potential for activity, but it won't be intelligent activity any longer. It may be activity associated with some level of knowledge. So it's kind of like saying, if you think about everything I just said, it's kind of like defining this whole thing as knowledge and, okay, knowledge and energy, which also has incorporated within it power and forces and the ability to create new life. All of those things are like the leftovers that came from originally monads, the field of monadic experience. The monads become all of these elements that eventually go on to create life. If you don't have forms and you don't have spirit, if you don't have some element of power which allows the creation of new life, and if you don't have forces which produces a thing called evolution, then you can't have a system of kingdoms and life, etc., develop. It just doesn't work. You got to have all these things. They're like the building blocks that are necessary. And knowledge is the imperfect realm of intelligence. Knowledge is what's left over after intelligence is no longer perfectly communicated from one thing to another. Now, a very interesting thing takes place. When you have a lot of, well, any amount of, we'll call it that way, any amount of there being forces and or the creation of life, usually the two are accompanying together, the result is that because the mind of God becomes so separated at this point, because all in every step of the way, the mind of God is becoming more and more separated. Even in monads, the monads are separated from God's mind because they actually have more consciousness in some ways than God had at its inception. But and then because of the imbalance between that and their ability to take activity, they're not anywhere near their creator. They have to grow themselves. And because their choices are limited by their own sacrifices, they're not. Their mind is different from God's. It's kind of an obscure or skewed type of God's mind. May have the size may not be too dissimilar in some respects, but they have a very enlarged consciousness, but decreased will or choices and decreased activity, even in the potential that God has. God has the greatest potential of activity. But a monad can become, if it's ascended, a closer part of their creator and experience God. But they have to go through this whole thing of creating life first. And that's what they're going to do in the spiritual realm, on that third plane, the spiritual plane. They're going to create how life is made. They're going to even make new life, as well as create the forces that regulate life that already exists, otherwise known as evolution. So it's really a kind of a system that is just unbelievably simple in some respects. I mean, granted, it sounds complicated by human standards for me to sit here for 30 minutes and explain it to you, but, you know, in reality, to be able to explain how life is created in the universe in 30 minutes is a pretty amazing thing. And that means that it's not as complicated as we might think. It's just big. Complicated, not so much. Big yes. Okay. So, we've got this system, but something else is happening. Once you've got less than intelligent activity, new things change in the dimension of time and space they exist in. In the spiritual plane, this ability to be in all time by being present in thought with all other beings is missing. Now, spirit is confined to a form, which is made out of energy, and must use some level of knowledge to be able to form itself another spirit because it no longer communicates perfectly, which produces two things. It produces time, or a waste of time, and it no longer thinks at the same speed of light as either a monad or of God. And as modern physics states, when something is moving or communicating even at less than the speed of light for that dimension, these are much faster speeds than what we're used to talking about light, but when something is communicating at less than the speed of light, two things happen. Time is used up. So time exists then. You waste time. We just call it, in human terms, oh, that's a waste of time. We're wasting time. Because it's a, if you perfectly communicate, there's no time at all in the communication. Time doesn't even exist. You exist in a timeless state, like God. But we aren't in that state. And all spirit is not in that state. So it's in a state of using up some level of time. And it's in a state where, in order to be, quote-unquote, in touch with other life, it has to traverse a gulf between itself and the other life, because it puts itself at a space between its form and the form of other spiritual things, entities, beings. And that space is what we call space. It creates space between itself and everything else. So the light is diminished. The space is created and then increased over the dimensionality slowdowns as you move from one part of a dimension to its lower parts and eventually to lower dimensions. Space increases and time becomes more and more prevalent. Because time really is a measure of the quality of the space. How much is space becoming increased, or is it decreasing? If it's decreasing, you're saving time. It takes less time to communicate. And if you are increasing space, it takes more time to communicate. Just think of it in terms, just like you had a friend that lived a mile away. You want to communicate with that friend. No matter what means of communication you use, it's going to take longer if the friend is 100 miles away than if they're a mile away, no matter what form of communication. That's true. And it's true at a bigger scale and a universal scale. And you could just say that all the time it takes is just wasted time. Because the ideal would be to perfectly communicate, which means no time is used at all. Then you're not wasting any time either. Wow, tell me that isn't cool. This is pretty neat stuff. So knowledge now becomes the tool used by spirit. And spirit, at the highest level, in the spiritual world, spiritual dimension, is all knowledgeable. It has all the knowledge it can use. Some of that knowledge is not perfect knowledge. Some of it is. Some of it actually has intelligent activity to it, but most of it isn't. But at least it has all the knowledge it needs to do anything. Wow, that's pretty cool. That's called omniscience. So in the spiritual world, everything is omniscient. And as a matter of fact, that's true when you get to the next world, the intuitional or Buddhic world, the Buddhic dimension of time and space. at the very top, or the very when you just enter into that dimension at the highest level. In that dimension, at the beings that are fully containing the experience of that intuition, they also have omniscience. They have all knowledge. But if you lower your ability to use all knowledge, so use omniscience, then it becomes limited to certain lower dimensions and kingdoms only, and not to everything in all of the dimension you're in. Wow. Very interesting stuff. Fascinating. So knowledge becomes sort of, we could call it, the new way of employing thought. We could even say that below the monadic plane, knowledge is part of all thought. It is. Knowledge is incomplete in some aspects, but it is part of all thinking. And therefore, since all thinking is incomplete, so is all of life. Because spirit and form or energy are all part of what we call life, at least at the point where we enter the spiritual dimension and below. Okay, so I'll leave you with those tidbits of thinking for right now. And we'll be back in about 2.5 minutes, and I'll continue with the creation and development of knowledge.
Hi, everyone. Since childhood, I've had questions about my life and life in general that I couldn't find adequate answers to. Questions like, why am I here? Why are others here? Does the universe have a purpose? And how does that relate to my life? More recently, I've been wondering what happens when we die, especially the reasons why. I'm more of a doubter than a believer in many things, and answers that include the whys allow me to think and figure out the truth for myself. I've been reading a book, Life's Hidden Meaning. This one book contains more answers, including the whys, than all other sources I've read or heard. It's amazing to me that every one of my questions has been thoroughly answered. More importantly, I have found that all of these answers so far have checked out to be true. I hope this message helps some of you in your quest for better understanding. The name of this wonderful book is, again, Life's Hidden Meaning by metaphysician Niles McFlower. Some bookstores sell it. I got my copy directly from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Life's Hidden Meaning may enlighten your mind and bring some peace and joy to your heart.
Hun, what book are you reading?
It's a novel, kind of, about romance, love, and spiritual life in general.
Kind of a novel? What do you mean?
Well, it's based on some real-life experiences and even real characters. Some of their experiences are fascinating and remarkable. I can't put this book down.
How come the title is Afterlife Love?
That's part of the fascination. This book describes the afterlife in intricate detail and even explains why things are the way they're explained.
But how can anyone write about or know that?
Some of the characters travel out of body to some places that people who've already died also go to. I'm finding it completely believable because it all makes sense and fits into a bigger picture for me.
Hun, what happens to these people?
You can read it for yourself when I'm done if you want.
Better yet, I'll get my own copy so we can discuss it while we read. Let me see. I'll write down the title. It's Afterlife Love by Niles McFlower. McFlower.
Afterlife Love is available in some bookstores and from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com or 480-966-3132. That's 480-966-3132.
This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. Tonight we're talking about the creation and development of knowledge. Okay, so that first section of the show was a real, we'll say, mind bender, right? Because we finally got to the point where we understand, maybe, where knowledge comes from. It comes from incomplete intelligent activity, incomplete. And it sort of splits apart. The intelligent part becomes knowledge, and the activity part that's perfect now becomes energy and forces and power. Amazing. Power helps to create life, new kinds of life. And forces tend to create or can create evolution. Now, what do I mean by evolution and forces? If you think about the model that evolution is in scientific terms, it is really about one kind of life having a, we'll call it impact on another kind of life, or the environment itself outside of other life having impact on life that exists in the environment. And in either case, the two produce what we call energy against energy. A force is developed when one kind of energy is not moving in exactly the same direction within the same field as another energy. And so if two life forms, two kinds of life forms, exist within the same field, that field could be a planet or it can be a niche, it could be anything you want to call it. It within that range of field, if the energies are not moving in the same direction, then the results will be forces, a force, and it could be multiple forces. So one life produces forces against another life. And you say, well, what happens if they move in the same direction? Well, then they reduce forces. So that's a good thing. But when they reduce forces and when they're moving in the same direction, you're starting to get closer to the knowledge being more and more intelligent. Because they have, in order to move in the same direction again, they have to be able to communicate. And if they communicate better and better, and they work together, so to speak, then the results are that you stop having evolution, you start having spiritual life, and you start being able to create new life as a result of that, rather than have life evolve. The problem with evolved life is that it reduces. It doesn't increase life, it reduces life. You didn't know that, but that's true. It actually reduces the amount of life because one form of life is always at being growing at the cost of some other elements of life. It's a competition, you might say. Even when there is only limited forms of life and they kind of don't intermingle too much, there's still some forces developed if they coexist in the same field. Okay. And if they're working together, well, then they're starting to become a spiritual form of life. And in order to do that, they have to be able to use knowledge to a very high level, changing the knowledge somewhat back into intelligent activity, and that's done by balancing the amount of spirit or thought to the amount of activity. You need about twice as much thought in the spirit to think for the activity or the energy and itself. You have to have twice as much. And that only occurs when you get to the buddhic or intuitional plane. It doesn't work below that. And the first kind of life that can start developing itself in the spiritual life is human life. Everything else is controlled by semi-spiritual thought coming from what are called group souls. And those group souls can only average the life that they have some effect on. So zillions could be of ants or whatever. Could all work together in some respects, but two ants or three ants or five ants would have a hard time achieving any kind of result. One ant, very hard time becoming a spiritually integrated being onto itself that would create a life without forces. Interesting. Very interesting. So evolution is part of the system of life, but it doesn't explain why kingdoms exist. It doesn't explain how life eventually becomes spiritual, which shows a non-need at that point for evolution. and it shows cooperation with evolution by more spiritual life. So all kinds of interesting things come about through this system of knowledge. All right. So where does knowledge seems to be not too bad when it's omniscience? And it's omniscience from the top of the Buddhic plane up or into the spiritual plane. There it's all omniscience. It's part omniscience anywhere in the Buddhic plane below the highest or atomic level. Still pretty good. But then you get to a place called the monastic or mental world. And knowledge now has a lot of glitches. What are those glitches? Well, the activity has broken, or the intelligence, I should say, that's controlling the activity, has slowed itself down to the point and has created so much space between itself and other life that the only thing it can do is balance one wrong or incomplete part of knowledge with another incomplete part of knowledge so that the forces are mitigated for a while. This we call truth. But it just doesn't work for very long. I mean, in human terms, it might be a whole lifetime. But in spiritual terms, it's a very short period of time. And so even if you balance all the forces for 100 years with knowledge, after 100 years, new knowledge enters the picture that shows the incompleteness of the old knowledge and the life. That's because life grows. And what was good for life at that older junction doesn't work anymore. And what was true is no longer true because the life has become more intelligent. And it needs knowledge that is more true for more examples outside of the ones that it was living within in its prior time. As those examples grow, because the life itself has grown, it says, this knowledge doesn't work anymore. So you can use classic Newtonian physics for hundreds of years. It seems to work okay. You can build railroads, steamships, bridges, all kinds of stuff. Works fine. But then you start getting into electronics and subatomic realms and outer space and astronomy that goes deep into the Netherlands of time and space, into other galaxies and even other star systems and other galaxies. And suddenly, the Newtonian physics falls apart. It just doesn't work. At the very beginning, it doesn't work among the planets within our own solar system in a slightly off way. Doesn't bother too many people in the beginning, but eventually it's a big deal. And then when it doesn't work between stars and on and on, then because we have evolved, we have grown in a spiritual sense and maybe somewhat evolved, but mostly grown, the results are that that knowledge that worked so well 100, 200, 300 years ago isn't working anymore. And you have to get new knowledge. That's what's wrong with mental knowledge. The truth of today will almost certainly not be the truth of some distant tomorrow. That's the problem. And that's the problem that science doesn't yet get. There's a thing called epistemology. I'll get it. Epistemology. I still not saying it right. You are trying to understand how the knowledge of something interacts with the mind of the observer, so to speak. And it's a part of philosophy, actually, but it really has to do with science as well. And science doesn't get this relativistic issue of truth and knowledge. And because of it, it thinks that what's true for today will be true for all time. And again, if anything is certainly not true, it's that. And that's the problem. So those who are listening that may be scientists, think about what I just said. So it is important at this stage for us to recognize that the development of knowledge is on a mental level, where most humans develop knowledge, very incomplete, almost always untrue, and even when it is true, it has a limited time. It's sort of like the date stamp on most food and other things. When it expires, it's gone. No good anymore. Now, the interesting thing is that sometimes old knowledge can work in limited circumstances. We still use classical physics in engineering, bridges and other things all the time. It's just that if you're building satellites that are global positioning, and you're trying to figure out where they are in time and space, it doesn't work because their speed relative to where we are in the ground is too fast, and you get into a thing called relativistic time shifts, and their time isn't right. If their time isn't right, their location isn't right. So you have to adjust for that. And that's just the beginning. That's before you get into the subatomic world, where if you think that physics is strange, that's still part of classical physics. It's just a advanced classical design using Einsteinian thoughts. But when you get into quantum physics, everything changes because you're dealing with probabilistic issues rather than certainty issues of the way that energy or activity are interacting, changing their level of relative level of perfection. As you slightly change even the smallest change in energy's perfect activity, level of perfection, inactivity is what I should say, you change the definiteness of the matter itself and the probability of what it's going to do. So physics becomes a very relativistic and probabilistic issue, and eventually becomes something other than what we think of as physics. It becomes more philosophy and extra-dimensional, and it has more to do with God's mind, by far, in thought, than it has anything to do with what we think of as physics, which is about matter. That's how knowledge is so critical to understand. There are some practical issues about this, and I don't want to get too extreme in tonight's show, but there are some very practical issues about the development of knowledge. And if we were to start examining these, it would create humility, or greater levels of humility in us. And for that reason, that's the reason I'm going to spend some time tonight talking about these practical issues of development of knowledge, because it allows us to get over our egotism, and for a few people at least, some of their arrogance, so that we become more open-minded. And for sure, that's a very good thing. It would be nice if we all could be a bit more open-minded. Okay, before I get into that, let me just mention a couple of things. If you haven't already heard, I've already told you a bit about these orthotics that I'm using. And I'll tell you right now, Dr. Jarrett has created these orthotics, and I find they really work for me. Now, if you have posture issues, even sometimes lower back issues, certainly foot issues, if you've got foot issues, big time, then you might want to try his Theta Orthotics. You can go to the thetaorthotics.com website and take a look at them. But the important element here is that what's so different about these is that the orthotics are built in layers, and you can use them in layers. And over time, you change the curve He uses differential calculus to do this. But you change the curve of your foot to develop more of a normal arch. Normal orthotics do not do this. They average it. And you get a certain kind of curve, and that's all you get. His are designed to build your curve back to where it was to begin with, and nobody knows where that curve really is, so you've got to kind of work with yourself to find it. And he allows you to do that through his system. This is a great system. I do suggest that you try it. Even if you're using regular orthotics now, you may want to shift. They aren't very expensive. They last almost indefinitely. And it does make a big difference. No matter what kind of foot problem you have or other issues related to feet, this is a good place to start. So give it a try. I want to also mention Dr. Brendan McCarthy. Now, he's here in the Phoenix area. He's over in Chandler. Yeah, that's a suburb of Phoenix. And he has a place called the Protea Medical Center. The address is 1949 West Ray Road. He is my doctor, my physician. Now, why do I go to him? And I can tell you that this guy is a healer. He's a great, great doctor. He's a naturopath, and his different methods that he employs that can be helpful. From traditional allopathic medical issues, he can deal with some of those, and he can also get into the more Chinese-related and other Eastern methods, herbal methods. He's a great guy, and you're going to like him. And he's inexpensive in relative terms. This is important. He has fees that are like from 25 to 50 years ago. I mean, that's pretty cool. So he's great. And he has a place that is a walk-in. You can just go. He takes emergencies. How many places like that can you go to? He's not like these dock-in-a-box places where they charge you $200 to go in and breathe. I mean, you know, that's not him. He charges what the lowest price doctors do when you make an appointment a month ahead of time. And if you want to find out more about it, go to ProteaLife.com. All one word, ProteaLife. ProteaLife.com. He's open 6 days a week. His hours are 9 to 6 Monday through Friday and 11 to 4 on Saturday. And remember, he does urgent care. So, I mean, if you've got something really important, you've got to go right now, he's available. He does all kinds of everything. He also does acupuncture. I mean, the whole nine yards. So he does everything. And very reasonable. Very reasonable. Got to try him out. And especially if you don't have insurance, let me tell you, this is the guy to go to, because the other people you can't afford anyway. So, I mean, unless you're very wealthy. And if you want to know his phone number, now, again, this is the Phoenix area, but if you're out of town, I would, you know, if you're traveling through Phoenix or whatever, I would go see him rather than anybody else. His number is 480-557-9095. You can even call him for a consultation if you're living far away. Like if you're in another state and it's, or even another country, you might give him a call. You might be of some help even over the phone. Of course, it's always better if you can get to see him in person. Dr. Brendan McCarthy, McCarthy. Okay, so let me go back now to this idea of knowledge, because most people don't realize that knowledge develops. And the amount that you are willing to use knowledge as a tool rather than as a burden and something that you confine yourself with, the more you're able to become more a spiritual person. And what do I mean by that? Let's take a look at some of these ways of examining the process of developing a good use of knowledge. when someone has developed a level of knowledge that they can develop large concepts, they can say, tell themselves and others why something is happening at the very, very largest site of life, of existence. Yet, at the same time, they can come up with multiple examples using things called thought forms. And those examples consistently are supported by the why of the concept. That's a test of the knowledge's truth for the situation that they are describing. And if people learn to do this on a regular basis, test their knowledge of, there would be a world in which there would be much better communication, because the closer to truth that two people are, the closer they are to intelligent communication together, the more the activities between them waste less time and the less space there is between them in both their minds and, in effect, their bodies. So knowledge is an interesting commodity, virtually. It's a means to develop ourselves into higher beings and to do so together with others. If we respect what the knowledge is in and of itself and we realize that it's imperfect, especially in human terms and the way humans use it, we have some abilities as human beings to use some levels of controlled and uncontrolled intuition. But even with all those together, we still rely mostly on knowledge for our thinking base. We don't think much outside of knowledge, and very few people think virtually at all outside of knowledge. And most people use very incomplete knowledge, which means that most of the time they're far from the truth in their thinking, and therefore they waste lots of time and have a great deal of distance between themselves and others, lots of forces to develop between others and themselves. If you want to reduce the forces between people, you need to have more truthful knowledge that they share together. And that's one of the problems we're having today. In our world, most of the battles that are taking place are in the mental world. That's better than having them physical, no doubt about it. But it's still a large amount of the time. People are in disagreement about the knowledge that they have. And instead of developing a spiritual connection with someone together, they're developing forces between each other, which produces evolutionary dead ends and destruction to civilization. Whoa. Yeah, I mean, if you have two countries that are not getting along, let's use real examples. Let's say you have Palestine, which is not really a country yet, but they, depending upon who you are, you might believe they are or maybe they aren't. And they're having some major disagreements with the Israelis. The Israelis' knowledge, I'm going to use some examples here, because the Israelis' knowledge is that they need a buffer zone between themselves and people who have traditionally been their enemies, because if they don't have the buffer zone, their enemies do terrible things to them, including trying to annihilate them, which their enemies are continuously saying they're going to try to do or will do. Well, that's the Israelis' position. And then the Palestinians, along with other countries around them that are Islamic usually, are saying that the Israelis stole the land from the Palestinians that they occupy presently and shouldn't even be where they are. They also believe that the Israelis are in some way an affront to their own religion and in some way threatening themselves and their God. Yeah, they actually do believe something like that. Kind of a weird thing. It's if God's threatened by the Israelis, pretty strange. But they do believe something like that, the infidels. And those that are most infidel, strangely, are Israelis. But there's a strange thing there, and that is that the Israelis are part of their religion. So Judaic thought helped to develop Islamic thought, and they readily admit that. Very strange. But the Palestinians think that their land was taken from them by the Israelis. They also think that the Israelis are the infidels, but strangely, at the same time, they think Islam came partly from Judaic thought. So there's a kind of a contradiction there. But they think that the infidels are going to contaminate and destroy their style of life. So we have some changes here between the two positions because they're using different types of knowledge. The knowledge for the Palestinians is based upon their spiritual belief structure. The Israelis is not so much a spiritual belief structure, although one thing is that they believe they're supposed to be living where they're living. That part is their belief structure. But mostly it has to do with the Israelis dealing with the question of logic and humanism and fair play and survival. And it, with the Palestinians and their supporters, which are mostly some of the Islamic countries, some of those are Arab, they think that it's really about an affront to God, an affront to their religion, plus the removal of their property from their use and their autonomy in a political sense. So these two countries now are butting, or more than two countries, these two factions are butting heads. And they produce tremendous forces among themselves and in the world. And the solution to this situation is to find truth. Now, truth would only work for a while anyway, but it's better than where they are. And the truth is that the Israelis do not have to have necessarily exactly the land that they do have. But they already admit to that, even though they haven't executed on it completely. And the truth is that the Palestinians are interpreting God in a way which is evil. It's not God. God doesn't say that you go out and kill the infidels, or kill those that are in any way affecting your style of life. That's not God. That's anti-God. Now, can you change these levels of knowledge so that these people can become more spiritual? So that instead of it having knowledge that is contradictory to each other, you instead have knowledge that is somewhat similar, and that is truthful so that it will last for at least 50 or 100 years and gradually maybe forever if they constantly raise their level of knowledge and improve their level of truth to more greater understandings of the time, whenever that may be in the future. Yes. Can it be done? Yes, it could be done. The point here is that when you have people who are not willing to change their thought process, because knowledge is the way that people think, for the most part, the average development of humans of today. There's other ways to think than knowledge of mental knowledge. And the other problem is that the knowledge is colored by how people feel, and that's even more true, or especially true, of the Palestinian people in comparison to the Jewish people, although they have some of this on both sides, no question about it. So what would we want to see happen here? Well, if we're going to have forces reduced, we know based upon the spiritual principles that I have brought up so far, that it is going to be necessary to get these sides, these people, to convert or change their egotism into a form of givingness in thought. They have to be willing to give their thoughts rather than try to force their thoughts onto others. And they have to be willing to change their thought to be somewhat in accord with the other folks. It's not too easy to do in this situation, but there are some things that could happen. There could be zones put together where instead of there being a border as we understand them today, it might be good to make like sections 10 miles, 20 miles wide that are the mixture that neither side owns anything. It's just plain, it's everybody's territory, both sides' territories. And they have to live together in those territories. Now, why do I suggest such a crazy idea as to get rid of the boundaries of a country? Well, the boundaries will be fuzzy, just the way their thinking is, so that they, when they live together in these areas, those people become the people most willing to be accepting of the other people. So you're going to get those people to be the least resistant to making changes in their thought process. And they're also the ones that have the most contact and therefore are going to have the most forces if they don't change. This is a kind of a new experiment, if you want to think about it. You could call it like a DMZ zone, but where everybody lives rather than everybody stays away from it. And it allows them to find a new way of living together, which is going to be some kind of experiment. But neither side actually owns the ground. It's sort of collectively owned together. And the actual boundaries are more than 10 miles apart. So the people living in this 10-mile area are the guinea pigs trying to find the answers. But they only choose to live there voluntarily. And they will be the ones that are most willing to give and take and find some solution. And I suggest that this be done for a limited period of time, like 5 to 7, 10 years, where they only agree to live this way for that period of time. But equal numbers of each side are put in that position, put there only by their own choice, but they're given the tools. And the tools are supplied through financing and other things coming from governments supporting both sides of these factions. They just supply numerous amounts of materials and wealth, etc., for these people living in the middle, because otherwise they would have no economy to depend upon because there's nothing there right now. And this would be sort of like a mini country between the two countries, and those folks would need some support. But the people who support them, which are the factions on both sides, will also have to learn to get along because they're going to be collectively putting in their resources to do this grand experiment. I know this sounds a little outrageous, and it maybe sounds impossible, but I think it could be tried. You don't have to do it around the entire border of both countries. You could do it in a little section and gradually grow it. They have tried something like this already in Jerusalem, but unfortunately, since the time of the polarization issues in the last 20 years, it's gotten to the point where they really don't have any mixture of people anymore, and they've segregated. So this would be an truly equal boundary issue. Eventually, you would want to bring the whole city of Jerusalem into this equation, but maybe not to begin with. I would start in a more outlying areas where there's nobody or very few people, so that you can start afresh. And it has some interesting thoughts to it, because you're using activity. You're using some of the process of God's mind. You're using activity as part of the solution instead of just trying to get together in a room someplace and figure out a solution and make it a treaty that nobody's going to listen to and everybody's going to hate. This is more like the only solution to life maybe is life itself, and people are going to just have to get together and try to live it on an experimental mode and see how they can work it out together. Now, if you think this is a good idea, you might want to say, hey, I was listening to this guy's show, and this is an idea that I think is good, and put it up on the Internet, and I'll try to promote it. Because we need some new ideas, new ways of thinking about these kinds of problems to find solutions, because the knowledge levels are so incomplete and, so, in some cases, so fallacious that they're never going to be resolved by the two sides trying to find a quote-unquote compromise. You can't compromise positions of hideous untruths. They don't compromise. They just become more and more entrenched in their forces. So we need something. You got to kind of leapfrog and go into something that's creative. And the way to create a solution is to come up with something that involves activity. Activity will produce in relatively short order solutions that you can't produce with just thought alone, because you need all three parts of God's mind to make significant changes in life that aren't forceful, you see. Okay, so hopefully with that through this model, as I'm suggesting, you try to get as close as you can to intelligent activity instead of unintelligent activity. Unintelligent activities where both sides just shoot each other and shoot rockets, and the other side comes in with airplanes and destroys them. I mean, just that's unintelligent activity. Intelligent activity is one of the things that would be a much more intelligent activity to attempt to try. All right, so let's also talk about some of the other means of, we'll say, dealing with knowledge, now that we know it is incomplete, that by its very definition, especially mental knowledge, where humans function most of the time, it doesn't even represent truth, and it has a terrible waste in time, produces enormous forces, and is terrible. A lot of people say, well, let's go back to just feelings, like the Atlanteans have done. Well, the problem with that is that human beings have to create from their highest and not some medium or low level of functioning. When we go to a lower level of functioning, we are lowering ourselves into like being animals. Even if we're very well good animals, it doesn't move us ahead towards the superhuman and more spiritual life that we seek, and life becomes meaningless. So we don't have that option. Not in a real sense. And assuming that we all wanted to have more meaningful lives and be closer to our Creator, then we're going to need to deal with this from the mental level, regardless of how difficult that may seem. That's a fact. What else can be done on a more, we'll say, wide scale, rather than, oftentimes I talk about, you know, meditation, education. Those sort of things are very important, but there's always the issue of intelligent activity. So in terms of what can be done, I think the pressure here is on the activity side. And the best way to find solutions, as I just tried to show with the Israelis and Palestinians, which is a very big problem, obviously, is to use the model of the third part of God's mind is more often than not being the quickest and the most efficient and least disruptive solution, at least once you've thought through and gotten your thought together, even though they may be different between you and the other parties. So what actions can we take? One of the things I'm concerned with today in the United States, but also in other developed countries, but it's all throughout the world, believe me. It's not just everybody thinks it's just the imperialists, the big fat countries, etc., is corruption. The need to overcome corruption is the same need to change knowledge that is untrue into truth. And corruption comes from a process that involves the first ray in politics. The issue about it is basic, and that is that people who have a tendency to want to control others, usually they're called first-ray personalities, but sometimes it's first-ray-minded people, other types as well. Those, when you have certain characteristics as a human being, you may want to control others and to gain or take from others. Now, this is dark. There's no question about it. And eventually it becomes evil. But we have an epidemic of this. And the reason for it is because evil has moved into a process in the last 100 to 150 years of using propaganda predominantly, which is a means of lying on a mass scale to people and convincing them that you're telling them the truth. Okay? It's a propaganda machine type issue. And what we can all do that would be helpful would be to educate ourselves and not buy into the lies that is in the corruption machine. Now, in some cases, people have weaseled themselves into areas where they're somewhat protected from the ultimate solution towards corrupt politicians, which is to vote them out. It's very hard to vote out judges because they usually run unopposed, as an example. And they, once they're in, they almost are in for life, even though they may get elected every 2 to 6 years, four years being average. And so it's a difficult thing. Sometimes they're appointed, but that's no better because then they're appointed by politicians who are crooked. So those kinds of circumstances takes more active participation than just voting. You've got to communicate the level of corruption that you find that others may be unaware of. So if we're going to deal with this really terrible problem of corruption, it requires public relations and communication in those areas where there are wayward politicians who are doing bad things because they are wielding power and discretionary thought in ways that is very harmful and very selfish. There may be criminals and thieves and stealing from others. And they are damaging not just their area political issues. They're damaging the whole world because they're promoting something that is part of evil. We have a responsibility to educate ourselves about those that are doing this and to communicate it as best as possible to all those around us so that it can be heard and understood. This is a way that knowledge can be brought to a higher level of truthfulness and so that more people can participate in getting rid of some of the things that are destroying our civilization. Corruption being really near or at the top of the list. Each of us has a responsibility to open our minds and to become part of a network of communicating about any time that the awareness of some corruption is taking place and to try to prevent politicians from gaining office who are lying and get rid of politicians as best as we can, who have already done that and have lied in office, and then get rid of those who are almost not elected, or what level they're elected from is very hard to get them out, like judges and other types of politicians, maybe sometimes board of supervisors, and people that they are technically elected, but in some areas it's almost perfunctory because they run almost unopposed. If you find someone that is running unopposed, try to find someone who will oppose them, especially if they are promoting things that you find are untrue or they're living a life that is untrue. Do what you can. Now, I happen to know that there are some places that there are people running unopposed right here in the state of Arizona, like the mayor of Tucson. If you know that someone is running unopposed, now I brought this up several years ago on a prior show when I was on it was another station. And when I was on that station, I promoted that people should not let other people run unopposed. It doesn't make sense. imagine a major city like Tucson where someone's running unopposed. That doesn't make any sense. So you would want to have someone running opposing that person. And in this particular case, I think there's concern. You might want to look into that situation. Now, how is it that knowledge is so important then in that situation? Well, it's because when someone is corrupt, what they do is they use knowledge to convince other people that they're going to do something for them, help them in some way, which is very selfish, oftentimes, and manipulative. It produces a kind of effect that is like toxic to the mind because it's enticing to the astral nature of people. It gets them to believe, if you want, that they're going to almost immediately get something in return for their vote. It's a quid pro quo kind of thing. Vote for me and I'll give you this, you know, free this, free that, whatever. It truly is the basis of corruption. In addition, sometimes people espouse platitudes and promise things that they can't possibly deliver because when you examine their platform or their reasoning of how to achieve what they want to achieve, there's nothing here. They're just making statements like, well, I want everybody to be able to have free this and that because it's good for them. I want to improve the school system 100% next year. Now, how are you going to do that? They don't tell you. That's why you want to challenge people. That's why you need to have a, we'll say, check and balance system in thought, you know, that looks at the knowledge people are using, the amount of knowledge and the kind, and you want to see how whole that knowledge is. And does it represent truth, at least as we come to it in the mental world? This is a situation in which it has become an almost accepted practice. The politicians in some way are immune from speaking the truth and from speaking from any kind of reasonable wholeness in their knowledge. It's like, well, he's just a politician, so he can say whatever he wants. But I'll still vote for him. Yeah, that wouldn't make any sense. If you have a situation where someone is running unopposed, encourage someone to run that you think is a good person, even if they can't win, because they will challenge the issues of the person who might win but is getting a free ride, or who you think is really not telling the truth. Even if they are elected, then, they might be more forced to perform some of the duties in ways that are less corrupted, because they'll be under a microscope. People will be watching because it came up in the election, even if they won it. So that's the good way. That's the way that we want to make sure that knowledge is used in a way that is helpful and beneficial. Now, let's get to bring it down. We'll bring it down to a more personal level for a few minutes here so we can kind of get an understanding of what that really means. Let's say that we're looking at a situation in your own life, or my life, or anybody's life, where you believe that what you think is correct, you know, and you don't necessarily agree with some other people that you know or don't know, but you believe your way is correct. What's the best thing to do? Try to think from the other person's viewpoint and see how much of their viewpoint has truth to it before you think of your side of the equation. Why do you do that? Well, because it gives you perspective. It allows you to challenge your own thought. In addition, if you can bump it up a notch, assume that the other person or people are right, and that you're probably wrong, and see if you can get them to explain to you how you are wrong, if you can have that level of communication. If you can't, then assume their position as if you are them, and do the best you can from that standpoint. Those are great techniques for allowing each of us to challenge our own levels of truth in our mind and to see whether or not our thought processes are open-minded, have some reasonable, we'll say reasonable level of truthfulness to them, because they're never going to be fully truthful, I can guarantee that. Not going to get there. But you can get close or closer. And I think that that's probably what most people can expect as the outcome. I'll be closer to the truth. Some things I'm just not going to be there. And also, admit when it appears that you are incorrect and not truthful. Stop and admit it to yourself and to others at the same time. The admission of having made, quote-unquote, a mistake allows us to be grateful to others, to be more loving towards others, and even to ourselves, and permits us to make changes readily in our thought process that could prevent us otherwise from changing for a very long time, meaning that we will operate in ways which will create forces in our life. Remember, every time that we are thinking in ways in which the knowledge is incomplete and wrong and or wrong in our mind, we are producing more and more life forces. Most people aren't aware of that. They think, oh, well, so what? So I think this way and everybody else thinks that way. How does that cause any problems? Well, it actually might not produce that many problems for some people outside of yourself. But for yourself, it's going to produce enormous problems because your life is going to be filled with forces. And those forces will reduce the level that you can live your life, reduce your level of thought eventually, and destroy your ability to create. Now, you might be able to destroy a lot. You might go around being a very destructive person, but the ability to be a creative person and create things that will last is not going to be there, because you can create things, but they will be destroyed by the forces that you bring about through your incomplete and mistaken thinking. And if that doesn't make sense to you, then let's try and look at it from another angle. You could, in reality, choose to base your existence on a life of being only for and of yourself, and say, I don't care what anybody else thinks. I don't even know if other people exist. You can be a solipsist and believe that the world is really a figment of your imagination. And you are the only person who exists. Some people think this way. And so you're going to live your life exactly the way you want it to be, because that's all that matters. Well, where does that lead to? It usually leads to the following. And that is that you end up in a situation where your existence becomes narrower and narrower, and the meaning in your life is reduced each day you live it. Why is that a true statement? Because the more fractured your knowledge is, and the more it is disconnected from others, the more you are disconnecting yourself from God. Because God is contingent upon the growth of life, and your life is not nearly great enough to give you much of an experience of God. So as you decrease your co-creation with God, the meaning in your life becomes almost nothing. And your life will become terribly boring, terribly lonely, terribly incomplete. And that's a good reason not to do those things. So are those kinds of people then doomed towards that? Yes, until they change. Because it's inevitable that that's the life that they will end up in. It's a wretched life, a terrible, terrible existence to even consider living. And without without making changes, a person is virtually doomed to live that life. Once you get into it, it's very hard to get out of it. Arrogant people, different than egotistical, arrogant people are people who are not only egotistical, they not only think they're right, but they think everybody else is wrong, and they don't care about what other people think. They don't love other people, they don't care about what other people think. Those kinds of people produce a very meaningless life for themselves. At their death from the physical world, they are some of the most unhappy people, the most unjoyous people that can exist. Yet, they tenaciously hold on to these really mistaken notions because they oftentimes have some severe personality problems. And those personality problems are so great, they want to control themselves, everything else around them to such an extreme level that they're willing to give up everything, including all meaning in life, all even happiness in life, for this craziness in itself. Okay, so if we're going to develop a basis of knowledge that is going to help us to develop a more meaningful life, then breaking through our desire to be in control, controlling others, negating the thought of others, and not caring about the thought of others, or not caring about anything about others, has to be changed. If you're one of those folks that I'm talking about, and you happen to be listening to tonight's show, I don't think you're probably a regular listener, but you may be listening, I can make some suggestions. The first is to assess other people's lives and see what level of meaning they seem to be getting, especially those that you so condemn, as a broad yardstick to measure your existence. Be as open-minded as you possibly can, considering the nature of your problem. And I think if you can get anywhere with that, it'll be a rude awakening to discover that others are actually living a much more meaningful existence most of the time than you are. That should be a good bellwether for some encouragement to change. Try to do it even if it hurts a bit. Even if you think it's a waste of time, do it as an exercise. Don't compare what you consider to be your status or money or whatever. Compare meaning. Is it meaningful? Now, what do I mean by meaning? Because that could be another tough problem, right? Because I'm using that word. I always think that everybody understands it, but meaning is the following. When someone finds meaning in life, they seek to grow more of it in themselves and others. When they don't find meaning in life, they do not seek to grow it in themselves, nor in or through others. Okay? So if you're, how much you're seeking to grow life in yourself and in others is a major part of how much meaning you have. There's two kinds of meaning. The kind that just grows yourself, and that's a limited kind of meaning. And then there's the kind that grows others, and that builds your soul and your higher self. You need to do a bit of both in most circumstances, although some more advanced people find that they only need to do it for others and not worry about or even think about themselves. They're spiritually more developed people and maybe disciplined in spiritual ways. Okay, so now let's get to the final issues of knowledge. The final issues of knowledge are that knowledge cannot be used in an effective way to get to God unless spirit is heading the process. Now, what do I mean by that? At the beginning of the show, I talked about how spirit separates from the monad, and you get spirit and you get form or energy. And knowledge was part of the energy to begin with. It was part of intelligent activity, but now it became less than fully intelligent, and then it becomes knowledge. So for spirit to return the knowledge to higher and higher levels until it eventually becomes intelligent, the spirit has to be the leading kind of thought. Now, what is spirit? Spirit is the thought of our Creator. When we think in line with our Creator, we are being spiritual and thinking in spiritual thought. And that leads, then, the knowledge. People who do not believe in God have a great deal of trouble with this process. It is almost always true that people who are arrogant don't believe in God. And so the interesting thing about this is that the two go kind of hand in hand. But I talked about a few minutes ago, and this really are kind of joining together. We need to increase our level of spiritual development. Spiritual development is that we create for the purpose of being closer to God in the long run. God being our soul, solar angel, monad, eventually God is God, but it may be all those things together. And so, ultimately, leading a spiritual life corrects most of the problems that we talked about, or I talked about earlier, in the process of joining together knowledge and the truth. If we want to look at the real problems as an example between the Israelis and the Palestinians and their sides or factions, each is not living spiritually enough, and in my opinion, the Palestinians have further to go with their process, even more to do. Even though they claim that they're fighting the Israelis in the name of their God, thinking it's a spiritual pursuit, it's anti-God to kill others because they don't believe in your God. So they have a serious problem there. Because at the same time they're being untruthful, they're being anti-spiritual. And that's a double whammy. Spiritual means you're getting closer to God in every thought that you make, and then in every action that you take that's guided by that thought, that spirit informing form, creating activity that's closer and closer to being perfectly intelligent. See how that fits together. Knowledge, then, is rejoining into intelligence. Leading a more spiritual life is the ultimate solution for all the things that we've been talking about tonight, and not everybody's ready for that. Not everybody has chosen to do that, but it is the best guideline. It is the best solution for the nature of the problem. Humanity today is factioning between those who don't believe in a God and who are atheists, and oftentimes fall into a lot of the problems I talked about with knowledge, and those who are spiritual and open-minded, and who are leading a life that will lead to greater and greater levels of spiritual connection, meaning that they're co-creating with their Creator. The desire is to create more of God in everything. Okay, well, we're out of time for right now. Sorry we lost a few minutes on tonight's show due to equipment issues, and we'll try to do a little better with that next week. Until next time, this has been Niles McFlower for Why Life Is.